I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 23rd of August. All things political coming up this hour, and our guest is Rebecca Cinderbrand, political news editor for The Washington Post. Before that, she was at Politico, where she was the deputy White House editor, and she worked at CNN. She was directing the political ticker there and oversaw coverage of the White House, Capitol Hill, and campaigns for Anderson Cooper's 360. She's covered politics for the AP and for Newsweek. We have a lot to talk about this hour, as we are going to be talking about the presidential run for many, many months. I think we'll probably start with Joe Biden. There are indications now, stronger and stronger, that he will make a run for the presidency, meeting with Elizabeth Warren over the weekend. He has chosen someone to be his new communications director. Donald Trump, we'll talk about him. Is he going to be a candidate who will survive until next year's primaries? And what is it about him that is attracting so many people to these rallies? Talking about many people to the rallies, Bernie Sanders is also attracting a lot of people. There is some concern that he needs to attract more African-American supporters. We'll talk about that. We will talk about Jimmy Carter. We'll talk about the continuing problem that Hillary Clinton faces with her emails and whatever else he would like to talk about. And Scott Walker, because the Post has been covering his run for the presidency fairly closely and what his thoughts are really when it comes to the 14th Amendment and whether he believes in the idea of birthright citizenship. Here's our phone number for you to join the conversation, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, where we love to get your messages, is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. KB Wheely is answering phones today, so say hello to him, and happy Monday. And happy Monday to all of you. Rebecca, hello to you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Let's start with Joe Biden. Does it appear to you that he's getting much closer to a run, Rebecca?
Well, you know, there's certainly more talk around it, and there are some signs. That doesn't necessarily mean that he's moving closer, but it certainly means that he's seriously considering it and talking about what it would take in order to mount a serious challenge to Hillary Clinton.
And is he really at a disadvantage? Because it obviously you've got people who've been in the race for quite some time now. It does take a long time to build a big campaign, doesn't it?
It takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of people, and it takes a lot of money. All of those are things that he'd have to get very quickly overnight. And, you know, the estimates is he'd have to get as much as $100 million for the primary season alone. So we're talking about just a huge amount of money that he'd have to raise in a very short period of time. And then you have the fact that a lot of the hardcore campaign talent, the experienced veterans of the Democratic Party, have already signed on to Hillary Clinton, or if they were inclined against Hillary Clinton, have signed on to Bernie Sanders or supported publicly Bernie Sanders. And so, you know, there are people, he has a network, but when it comes to the grassroots, Hillary Clinton has a huge head start.
Mm-hmm. Well, we were talking in the office this morning about whether or not there's concern among those big donors and other people in the Democratic hierarchy who think that Hillary is in trouble over these emails and thus have gone to Joe Biden and said, listen, we don't want to lose an election here. We need to have a candidate who's viable in case her campaign tanks. Two questions. Do you think that may have happened? And does she face that possibility?
Look, you know, are there some nervous voices in the Democratic Party now? Sure. There are others who are saying that this is a blip that Hillary Clinton is going to work through. There is no question that her team has had some trouble finding its footing on how to respond here. There have been these dramatic shifts in tone. And last week, she tried kind of joking about it at a press conference, kind of sarcastic joking. And that certainly didn't go over well with a lot of people and it made some donors nervous. The key is, though, what would be more disruptive? You know, she's still polling very, very well against Republicans in the general election. There's signs of some softness in some swing states, Ohio, Pennsylvania, key states like that, but still has an edge over her potential Republican matchups in the fall if she were to become the Democratic nominee. if you start another long, bloody primary process, and a lot of Democrats have flashbacks to what happened in 2008 and how that split the party. You know, they ultimately, of course, won the White House, but that was coming after 8 years of a Republican presidency, not 8 years of a Democratic one, when it's, you know, just a little bit tougher for the party to kind of hold on to the White House.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the way that she campaigns and the way that Bernie Sanders campaigns. She's not really doing large rallies. She's being very guarded about who she interacts with. A lot of people around her guiding her. Sanders has just got the shirt tails out, and he's drawing huge crowds wherever he goes. Does she need to open up a little bit? Is her campaign style not working for her?
You know, this is the eternal question, and there's a lot of debate over this. There is no question that she is campaigning very differently than Bernie Sanders is,
right?
And that her campaign is not as open, and she's guarded, and, you know, she feels as though she's been burned in the past, in her past presidential runs, as Secretary of State, as First Lady, by reporters. And so there's a very real mistrust of the media on the one hand, and also kind of making sure that she's not in a situation in terms of interacting with the public where she can't control the interaction, you know. There have been, you know, discussion and some hints at kind of larger rallies, and they said that there are larger rallies to come. One of the keys right now is, because there's all this energy around Bernie Sanders, it may be a good idea to kind of hold off on the full ramping up, because you don't necessarily want to have those comparisons. And the fact is, the kinds of crowds you see for an insurgent candidate in the summer before primary season aren't necessarily an indicator of support. You think about Howard Dean in the summer before John Kerry ultimately became the nominee. So, you know, there's no question that she's campaigning differently right now. We'll see how long that lasts.
Mm-hmm. Bernie Sanders, some are saying, has a great need to attract more African-American supporters, which is interesting because he has spent 50 years of his life fighting for civil rights.
But, you know, it's an interesting dilemma for him. As you say, the fact is, though, that he has been in representing the state of Vermont, which happens to be 95% white. And so he hasn't had a lot of interaction with African Americans in the same way a Democratic politician in other states, say someone who is representing New York or representing a southern state or almost any other state out west, might have that kind of interaction. And so he's been falling back a lot and pointing to his civil rights activism. And, you know, for a lot of the younger activists in particular in the Black Lives Matter movement, that's not enough. It's interesting to note, of course, he's made some moves over the past few weeks to kind of address that issue. He was in South Carolina this past weekend. He met with many African-Americans while he was there, went to Charleston, of course, which is incredibly a resonant place right now. Because of the police shooting earlier this summer, he's hired an African-American spokeswoman, Simone Sanders, no relation to him, who's been introducing him at his events. And he also came out with a position paper on criminal justice and on justice issues, talking specifically about discrimination in interactions with law enforcement. That's gotten a big thumbs up from many in the Black Lives Matter movement. They're happy with what they saw in this early position paper. So he is making moves. You know, the question is, of course, the Clintons have a long history in, you know, for instance, South Carolina, that early primary state. You have people there who have experience volunteering for three Clinton presidential campaigns, both of Bill Clinton's campaigns and, of course, Hillary Clinton's first presidential campaign. That's a huge, huge obstacle to overcome if you are trying to come in and build a new network among African-American supporters.
Imagine, if you would, and maybe you have inside information on this, I'm wondering what the dynamics are between the Biden and the Clinton campaigns as Joe Biden is considering a run. Isn't there a lot of awkwardness?
You know, there. You think, you know, they've had interactions in the past. They had lunch together earlier this summer, and there was a lot made of that. The president and the vice president had lunch today, and there was a lot of chatter about that, even though it's a regular occurrence. It's a dilemma facing the Obama White House in particular now, because there are some who would say, you know, these statements, supportive statements that they've been making about Hillary Clinton, particularly in defense of her, as there are further questions about the email situation and about Benghazi, whether these statements of support could be construed as endorsements, and whether if Joe Biden is now considering weighing in, they have to kind of think about the language now. It's really tough. And until that situation is resolved and we know more what the dynamic will be in the campaign, that is, whether he's moving towards Iran or isn't, there's kind of this stasis, and everyone seems to be kind of just waiting to see how the situation will break.
Mm-hmm. Rebecca, what does Biden offer that Clinton and Sanders do not?
I think, you know, with Joe Biden, and you see this time and again on the trail, he has an ability to connect with voters, Democratic base voters in particular, on an emotional level, in a way that Hillary Clinton has in the past sometimes struggled to do. She's not necessarily a natural campaigner. Joe Biden is, of course, you know, a natural campaigner. He'll spend, you know, the whole event meeting every last person there. And Bernie Sanders, of course, not necessarily the most kind of warm and cuddly guy, a very, very passionate guy, someone who people really believe in, but not kind of this natural campaigner who connects with people. And of course, there's also a great deal of affection for Biden and remembrance of, you know, his son passed away earlier this summer, and there was this outpouring of support for him. And so you're kind of dealing with not just these intellectual kind of connections that people may have to candidates. You're also dealing with emotional connections that some of the Democratic Party have to Joe Biden, even if they may kind of logically be leaning more towards Hillary Clinton.
So what does the president do in this case? Should he run? Does he just stay out and not give an endorsement? And what does that do to the Clinton campaign and to the Biden campaign, for that matter?
I mean, I think it's safe to say that you're not going to see the president weighing in on a Democratic primary, particularly if, you know, one of his former senior cabinet members and his vice president are running against each other. Of course, whoever wins the nomination, and right now we have to say it would be an enormous shock if Hillary Clinton did not, is going to have his full support. Whether or not we'll how actively we'll see him campaigning and where we'll see him campaigning, you know, that's an open question. But he's absolutely going to support whoever comes out at the other end. During the primary process, don't expect to hear a lot about it from the president.
All right, let's move to Donald Trump, because he certainly is making everybody confront issues that he's talking about and making people change their minds, and probably changing the way that everybody's campaigning, too. Because if you talk really loudly and you're pretty bold, people seem to like that. At least a good chunk of the Republican conservative electorate does like that. What are your thoughts on him, Rebecca? First of all, do you think that he is going to survive until next year's primaries?
I think, you know, what if this summer has taught us anything, it's that no one should make any predictions when it comes to Donald Trump.
Right.
You have a lot of Republican campaigns who looked at what happened last time around when you had a series of these, you know, insurgent candidates who appealed to the base of the party rise and then fall rather rapidly. And they just kind of waited for them to cycle through and, you know, then reemerged. And they were waiting for Trump's support to evaporate. And the fact is, while he may have a very, very real ceiling of support, there are a huge number of voters out there, more than any other candidate, who've said that they would never support him for president. He also seems to have, at least at this moment in time, put a big asterisk on it, a floor, a committed core of people who, at least at this moment, want to send a message, if nothing else, by expressing their support for him. You know, in some ways, you can compare it to the support for Bernie Sanders, and that there are people who feel as though the party is not responding to their issues, what's important to them, is not acting on what they would like to see. And so they're sending a message by supporting candidates who are promising to, you know, take on the party and return it to its core values.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this immigration issue for a while, because he certainly has put it front and center in the Republican field. He says deport the undocumented en masse, seize the money they try to send home, deny citizenship to their U.S.-born children. And now other candidates are having to say similar things and respond to him. All of this at a time when the Republicans would like to, at least some months ago, attract more Latino voters. That's not going to happen.
And, you know, this difficulty that this presents for candidates like Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush can't be overstated. I mean, these are people who came into this campaign with a message that of inclusion, wanted to, if not, you know, openly push for immigration reform ahead of border security, at least wanted to make the message of inclusion. And they're seeing very real passion from the base that no one expected to see necessarily at this point on the other side of the issue. Jeb Bush is kind of, in particular, finding himself caught in the crossfire. He's on the border today, the U.S.-Mexico border. It's a trip that had been planned long ago, a fundraising trip, but his team had been asked whether he might, in addition, include public events, go to the border with security. And for a long time, they'd said, no, he's not going to be doing that. They told our reporters that, you know, he's been to the border before. He doesn't need to go. That's changed. Today, he will be having a meeting with border officials, meeting with officials, local officials about security. And he will be talking to people close to the border on that issue. You know, in many ways, it's the un-Trump tour of the border. He wants to provide a contrast, and his team has made that clear in the messaging they've sent out ahead of the event, talking about how Donald Trump's plan is not a conservative plan, that it spends too much, that it's not the plan that's right for the Republican Party, and Jeb Bush is going to present a contrast.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Scott Walker for a moment. You've been covering the Post has extensively, his campaign as well. He's now fading in the polls. Post wrote a piece recently saying that Governor Walker can't seem to give a straight answer when it comes to the 14th Amendment or whether or not he believes in the idea of birthright citizenship. In the last 7 days, he's opposed it, then revoked that support, would seek to end it, then said he has no position on it, and then opposed repealing the 14th Amendment.
Right. He cycled through that. I mean, perhaps no one has struggled as much with this issue, and this isn't something that you necessarily would have predicted, as Scott Walker. You know, it's hard to say precisely why. It can't be that he didn't think that he would be confronted with the issue, particularly as Donald Trump surged in the polls. But yes, he's really struggled to respond on this question. He seems caught between saying one thing and seeing some sort of backlash. He's, you know, the last position that he'd held before he shifted in the ABC interview yesterday to saying that he wouldn't repeal the 14th Amendment was to say that he wasn't going to take a position on it at this time. It, you know, seemed to be an effort to avoid offending anyone. But of course, that sort of thing usually ends up offending everyone on both sides of the issue because they want to see where you stand. He has had trouble. And in part, it's in part because of Trump. Some of the base voters who might have supported Trump, supported Walker, are migrating to Trump. And also, he's just kind of struggling to find his footing. He's, as you noted in our story, he's shifting. He's promised donors who are very nervous about what they're seeing in Iowa, seeing in New Hampshire, where he's completely collapsed in the polls, and seeing nationally, he's promised them that they're going to see a more aggressive, a more sure-footed Scott Walker. Point his performance at the Iowa State Fair, where he pushed back at protesters. He's in his element when he's facing the other side. It's when he has to battle members of his own party and make the case that he's a better representative that he seems to be struggling a bit.
Yeah. We welcome phone calls. We're having all things political. We always do Mondays at 1 o'clock. We're looking again at, and I'd be interested in hearing from some of you who support Donald Trump, why it is you do. Do you think, whether you support him or not, that he is going to be in this for the long haul here? What is it that people like about him? Is it, as somebody was quoted as saying, a voter, he's teaching other politicians to stop being politicians. He comes on strong. He could say it gently, but I think no one would listen. So now nobody can say anything gently because nobody will listen. You got to be bold and say some things that are quite outrageous. What is the basis of the support? Is it a similar basis of that you find support for Bernie Sanders, who is, he is a politician, but not one of the big moneyed Bush-Clinton politicians? Is this just a anti-politician season that we're in at this point? Scott Walker, why do you think he's fading in the polls? What did you think about his answer when it came to the 14th Amendment? Joe Biden, would you like to see Joe Biden run for president? Do you think that you could put support behind him? Or do you not understand why he might do that? Whatever you'd like to chime in on. We'd like to hear from you so we get a sense of where voters are at this early stage in the process of the presidential run. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page, where we love to read messages, is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at KDunnShow. Our guest this hour for All Things Political is Rebecca Cinderbrand, political news editor for The Washington Post. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for Rebecca Cinderbrand. All Things Political is what you are listening to now. And we start with Judy in Dane County. Hi, Judy.
Hi.
Hi.
My comment is just that I'm a dyed-in-the-wool Democrat, upper middle class, educated, would probably rather die than vote Republican. But the one thing that I can see that Donald Trump is doing right, the one thing, is that he is not beholden to anybody giving him money. He made a comment on one of the Sunday morning programs, I believe it was, where he said, he was talking about all these politicians on strings, and he said, we have Scott over here, you know, who's beholden to, you know, the Koch brothers, and we have so-and-so over here. And, you know, if he keeps that message going, he's going to persuade an awful lot of people. That's just my comment. I'll take my comments off the air.
Thank you, Judy. Rebecca.
Well, that's certainly been a core part of Trump's message on the trail. He says, look, everyone else can be bought and sold. They're all beholden to their donors, whereas I am independent because of my wealth. And of course, that also opens you up to a very specific line of attack at some point, which is the same thing that faced Mitt Romney, the same thing that faces every candidate who of means, which is that you're out of touch with what regular people experience. Mm-hmm. So it's something that you can ride for a while. At some point, if it becomes too much of an asset, if it feels as though that's what's keeping him in the mix, you will see people start to make that attack.
Well, it'll add to the fact that he doesn't have to take money from any of these big organizations like the Koch brothers, et cetera, but also that he's just outside the political process. You know, he does developments. He's a businessman, right? He is not a politician, I guess.
That's right. And, you know, this year we've seen, particularly in the Republican Party, the candidates who have the most momentum, who seem to have gotten the biggest boost coming out of the debates, are the candidates with the least public experience. You have, of course, Donald Trump, who's never held public office, Ben Carson, who got perhaps the biggest surge coming out of the debate in terms of his poll rise, and Carly Fiorina, who ran for office once unsuccessfully. Those are the candidates who saw the biggest boost. And it's a year when you're seeing more than ever the outsider candidates are the ones that are attracting the greatest support.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to John in Milwaukee next. Hi.
Hello. Donald Trump seems to me like a person who's got a lot of heart, and he's a nationalist. He wants to look out for the country, and he's not a globalist like all the rest of them, or a Zionist like Biden, whose son is a gas monopoly official in Ukraine that we took over. He's not anti-Russian. He can deal with Putin. He can deal with Mexico. He can deal with China. And he might be good. He seems like he's good, but of course you can't tell till you pass the bill. But and then Bernie Sanders, the socialist banker friend, I don't think he's going to really be a socialist. And Hillary Goldman Sachs' daughter, a son-in-law, private Federal Reserve Bank a stockholder, and aggressive, and definitely not interested in the good of the country or the good of anybody but her family. So that's all I had, my thoughts on those. So thank you.
It's interesting he describes Trump as a guy with a lot of heart when one of his major messages to solve illegal immigration is send everybody home, take their money, and deny citizenship to their children. I don't know if that indicates a person with a lot of heart or not. Rebecca?
Well, I think, you know, one of the issues is he's resonating with people right now on that emotional level. He's got a lot of heart. They like kind of where they feel as though he gets where they're coming from and he understands what's happening. The problem comes, you know, the reason a lot of politicians speak in nuance is because policy solutions can be very complicated. So, you know, we had our fact checkers taking a look at the outlines of the policy plan that he rushed out on immigration, the general outlines, and it's not clear how it would work, if it would work, and it would be exceptionally expensive to an extent that it's hard to imagine Congress appropriating that kind of money. And so would this work in the real world? Not necessarily, but it's something people want to hear proposed. It's hard to fight that if you're trying to kind of come up with a workable solution to propose.
Mm-hmm. The other thing, though, that is troubling about all this, Rebecca, is this is the guy who started this whole birther thing, and it went on and on and on because of Donald Trump, and it's just not true. It's just kind of a waste of our time, and why we had to go through that is essentially because of Donald Trump.
And I think, you know, that's a strain of this that is very uncomfortable for people to talk about. It's certainly there. It's not necessarily something that he's actively seeking out. But of course, you know, when our reporters went to his campaign rally in Alabama last week, you know, there were people there who represented, you know, Confederate flag supporters and other people along those lines who were there kind of looking for supporters because they felt as though that was fertile territory for their message. It's also something that is a challenge for the Republican Party. And one of the reasons that, at least initially, you'd heard many Republican officials, at least privately, high within the party, speaking with great concern about the idea of a Trump run.
Right.
Because by saying things that resonate with the base, he forces other candidates, as you noted on immigration, but, you know, that's not the only issue, and it's not going to be the only issue. He forces them to respond as reporters begin to ask other candidates, well, do you feel the same way? And that kind of pushes the conversation into places that the party would rather not see looking ahead to a general election matchup.
Mm-hmm. John in Nisida, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I am fine.
Good.
I guess I just wanted to, you know, I think what people see in him is that he comes across as uninhibited to say whatever he thinks. And unfortunately, I think his message is, you know, I don't agree with it. But I think people tune into that, and I think he sort of feeds on their dark side. I try to watch all different news. I watch MSNBC. I watch Fox. I skip around. And I know the day, by coincidence, that I was sitting filling out my check for what I owed the federal government this year, I happened to have Fox News on, who was saying that illegal immigrants were getting tax refunds. And as much as I like to think that that doesn't play with me, it upset me at the time. And, you know, and I think that's what he feeds into. Whether that is realistic or it actually is a fact that they reported on Fox News, people hear it and it becomes truth.
Mm-hmm. Rebecca.
Yeah, this is the echo chamber, and that sort of conversation is something that the party, the Republican Party, has been battling for a while now. One of the problems that they're having in particular is that candidates who kind of push back on that message are having trouble gaining traction. You know, one of the things we've noted is early in the campaign, Jeb Bush in particular, for example, was pushing back at town hall participants who said things that he felt were insensitive towards immigrants or towards other people. He would push back a bit. And that's something clearly that doesn't necessarily play well with the base. And so, you know, we've started to see at other campaign rallies when Bush's name is mentioned, it's drawing boos. Is he necessarily going to reframe his message because of it? Not necessarily, but it clearly speaks to where the party is right now. And that's in part because of kind of this echo chamber atmosphere.
Thank you, John, for your call. Lou in Dubuque, Iowa. Hi.
Hi. I just, you know, Trump isn't going to win women, and he's not going to win the Hispanic vote. So even if he would, you know, get to the general election, he's not going to win, which many of the experts don't believe he's going to get the nomination. This guy, he never talks about the other arms of government that he's going to have to deal with. All he ever does is call people losers. And so the President Obama had great ideas and great things, and the Republican Congress stopped him at every point, or things would be a lot better. What, you know, having a guy like Trump in there who just calls people losers, he's going to call John Boehner a loser, he's going to call Harry Reid a loser if he doesn't get his way. We work in a three-armed system of government, and if we were in a dictatorship, I'm sure that Donald Trump would be probably a pretty good president. But unfortunately, we don't live in that kind of world. So he does appeal to the 25% of people that are absolutely ashamed that we ever put a black man in the White House, and that's who you're hearing from right now. So I don't think we should take him serious. Thank you.
Thank you, Lou. Do you take him seriously, Rebecca?
I think a lot of people are having to take him a lot more seriously than they expected to. You know, the feeling when he first started talking about Iran was, we've been here before. He's talked several times in past campaigns about jumping into the race and never quite pulled the trigger. And then when he actually announced, we noticed that he hadn't filed the paperwork necessary to be a candidate. And so we wondered whether it was a real announcement. And then it turned out that it was. And then we thought, well, he's just going to be an asterisk. You know, no, he's not going to gain any popular support. And he's just gained momentum. He's been on a pretty steady upward trajectory with a slight dip after the last debate, but gains at the state level, at some of the state levels. So it's rare to see a candidate leading in both Iowa and New Hampshire. Those are very different audiences, very different electorates, Republican electorates. He's managing to pull that off. So at this point, you know, can't predict the future, but no one should underestimate Donald Trump. His people are treating this run seriously in the sense that they've gone out and started to do the things some people have to do in order to have a legitimate campaign, to make hires, to develop a ground game, to think about how things might work past the first primary or two. So we'll see how far this goes.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you saw, I thought it was really a great piece of journalism, Matt Taibbi's piece in Rolling Stone about Donald Trump, in which he kind of shed light for me on this whole reality world television thing. I must confess, I don't watch those shows. And so, I mean, I know who Donald Trump is, and I know that he does this Celebrity Apprentice thing. And, you know, it's hard not to know who he is because of who he is. But he sort of thought that we're into this reality television kind of campaign now because of Donald Trump. And I was wondering, do a lot of people watch those shows? I mean, is that sort of our mentality now, that you know, you bump people off the island, you bump people off the business they're in, you get rid of people? It's all kind of one big TV reality show?
I think that one of the things people are trying to do right now, not just journalists, not just campaign officials, not just party officials, pretty much everyone who observes politics for a living, is trying to figure out, who is the Trump voter? Where's the biggest right. base of his support? Mm-hmm. And the fact is, it's a number of different groups. You, of course, have people who are very passionate about the issues he's talking about, in particular immigration, and like the kind of way he's presenting it. You have people within the Republican Party who like to see someone stand up to the establishment of the party. You have perhaps low-information voters who don't know much about politics, but like to hear someone offering that kind of, you know, blunt assessment of where the nation is and where it should go. So there's a mix of people. One thing, again, that it's important to remember, even as he has this kind of passionate support and is inspiring more conversation than we've seen around a candidate in some time, his negatives remain extraordinarily high. And he's the most divisive figure in the race, which is a tough thing to pull off in a race that contains, you know, a Bush and a Clinton, you know, political families that have inspired a great deal of passion on both sides. And yet Donald Trump is managing to attract more emotion than either of them.
I know. And it's something. Lou, thanks very much for your call. Steve in Madison. Hi.
Yeah. You know, with apologies for me, Trump is just noise and popcorn. It's not his. No substantial content at all, but that's my opinion. What I'm calling to ask, it'd be nice if you could give us some of the background conversation from the Washington Post. I'm curious as to who is considering considering John Kerry as an alternate presidential candidate for the Republicans, or Democrats, excuse me, and when he might come out of the shadows to express his interest, or what combination of factors would prevent him from doing so.
You would like to see him run, Steve?
Absolutely.
Because?
One, he's younger than the other. He's younger than Sanders or Clinton or Biden, and he seems to carry himself very well politically or diplomatically, and he deserves a shot also for having been savaged by the Republicans the last time he ran for office.
Rebecca.
I think, you know, we saw him a couple of weeks ago. There was reporting on our end that basically, I mean, he's ruled it out for this cycle. He's done none of the things that someone would do if they were weighing a presidential run right now, not even to the extent of Biden, in terms of having conversations with his network and with his closest political aides. So for this cycle, at least, he hasn't ruled out a presidential run at some point in his life, although it appears unlikely. He very definitely has not ruled it out, but he's also not pursued it. And he's specifically at this point not pursued it this year. We've had lots of names raised, but he's definitely not taking part in 2016, he said.
How old is John Kerry? He's not a young guy anymore, is he?
Well, he's a young guy when it comes to the Democratic Party this year, as he noted, your caller noted. One of the issues that the Democrats are facing is both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders they're not old, but they're certainly older than, let's say, Marco Rubio or Scott Walker or Ted Cruz. And so you have this generational contrast. Marco Rubio in particular has been looking to highlight it. And so that contrast is not one that works well for Democrats. John Kerry, again, not a hugely young guy himself. He's 71. So,
oh, he's 71.
Yeah, so it doesn't necessarily... you know, he may kind of appear younger, but he's not necessarily a young guy either. Not that that's necessarily a requirement. It's not, there's no rule that says that whoever appears kind of younger and more vigorous automatically wins, even though it worked for, you know, President Obama was able to kind of present that that aura and win the election. There may be a sense that that may actually work against candidates this time. There has been some talk about that.
Well, I think Biden said, didn't I read somewhere, that he was, if he ran, it would just be for one term.
That's right. You know, he said in the past, he's made noises that he wouldn't necessarily kind of serve two terms, although, you know, he hasn't ruled that out either. But we haven't heard from him about his specific plans and what he's thinking now in quite some time.
Right.
He had done a tour of kind of the early voting states earlier this year. He kind of went to Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina in rapid succession and kind of sparked a lot of chatter, and then said he was going to be making his decision at the end of the summer. And then kind of with the death of his son, that deadline, the definition of summer, got pushed back to the end of September. So we're going to have possibly a few more weeks of this chatter, possibly, before there's any kind of defined answer on where Joe Biden stands in 2016.
Rebecca Sinderbrand is our guest for All Things Political, political news editor for The Washington Post. We're welcoming your phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email is talk@WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter is @KDunnShow, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Gary in northern Wisconsin, hi.
Hi. I was just going to say that John Kerry is older than Hillary, but younger than Biden, and Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders.
Mm-hmm. How old is Donald Trump? Do you know, Gary?
Pardon?
How old is Donald Trump? Does anybody know?
I think I heard 69 once.
Is he?
So that's what I'm going
to say. He is. Yeah. He is, Rebecca.
He hasn't did any. Yes. Hasn't said any specifics about how he's going to pay for all these boisterous programs he talks about. you know, building up defense and, of course, sending the illegals back, just to name two.
Mm-hmm.
So.
He doesn't seem to need to fill out details, though, Rebecca, does he? Well, we'll get to that. You know, I'll hire somebody to do that. We'll get to that. There aren't a lot of details for this massive plan.
Yeah, and, you know, the interesting thing is this. At this point in the election process, the campaign process, typically you don't see a lot of details from candidates. They usually speak in broad outlines. The difference, of course, is he's promising much, much more than candidates typically do. He's promising, you know, to send all 11 million people, to deport all 11 million people. He's promising to kind of, you know, take positions and kind of force international partners to do things that they are not inclined to do. And so when you make those sorts of pledges and promise those sorts of things, it results in people asking for specifics far more quickly than they might otherwise. And so that's a difficulty he's facing. He has promised policy positions. He kind of pushed out the immigration position paper before he had necessarily been planning to, because there were kind of questions after his appearance on one of the Sunday shows when he kind of seemed a little fuzzy on details. The plan, the position paper, came out just hours later. There's another one on tax policy that's due to come out sometime in September, although, of course, you know, you never know, it could come a little bit sooner. So he is going to be releasing these policy proposals. They won't have a lot of details. They won't have a lot of specifics. And so we'll see if he kind of it feels as though he needs to fill in the blanks at all. My suspicion would be not necessarily.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Gary. Nick in Waupaca. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think it's super interesting with the gay marriage stuff that's happened with the Supreme Court and the shift we've had nationally in politics with that not being a wedge issue anymore. For people that's a super important issue for, it's essentially taken off the playing field. And I think with the first Republican debate, John Kasich made it pretty relevant that he was fairly moderate on a lot of these types of issues. I think with having fairly weak or at least questionable Democratic options, he's a viable option for Democratic voters.
What about this whole abortion debate that's taking place now in Ohio?
Yeah, I mean, that's still another one of these wedge issues. And you know, for me, it's not the most important issue, you know, as far as a lot of the other things. But a lot of with is bringing people who are poor up into the middle class. There's a lot of service to the poor Catholicism that I'm hearing in his politics, which is a lot reminiscent of Joe Biden, you know, I think.
Mm-hmm. Do you think Democrats will see him as a Republican alternative? Do they now, Rebecca?
I think, you know, kind of just circling back for a moment to what your caller called in about, the question of wedge issues in this election, the question of same-sex marriage, the question of you know, the controversy over abortion, he's absolutely right. They're not huge issues. They're not issues for the overwhelming majority of voters, but for a minority of voters who are very passionate and sometimes vote in disproportionate numbers, and particularly within the Republican Party in the primary process, have a huge impact. You know, as many as 50% of Iowa voters are evangelical after the last presidential caucuses, Republican presidential caucuses. These are issues that resonate. Ted Cruz, in particular, has made this a centerpiece of his strategy of several candidates who've been vying, which was unexpected. But because the field is so large, we've actually had several candidates, Bobby Jindal, Rick Perry, Mike Huckabee, and, of course, Ted Cruz vying for this vote. And Scott Walker this week, over the weekend, sent a message, an email message to pastors in partnership with an outside group to 100,000 pastors, telling them that he's going to, you know, part of this fight to take on funding for Planned Parenthood. Mm-hmm. He talked about the possibility of shutting down the government or letting the government shut down over funding to Planned Parenthood. On Friday, he held a big rally in Des Moines, which he called a religious liberty rally, in which he spoke to people who said that their rights had been violated in part, you know, one of the couples because they wouldn't serve a gay couple at the resort that they operated. So it's not resonating for everyone, but for the people for whom it's important,
right,
it's at this moment more central than people had expected it to be.
So it's very, very central in the Iowa caucuses, Rebecca?
That's the actual $64,000 question, whether this actually translates into votes. We're seeing more conversation about it just from this minority of candidates, these people who are competing in what Ted Cruz has called the evangelical bracket. But the call is absolutely right. The majority of the Republican field, the overwhelming majority of the Republican field, has steered clear. So you have probably two-thirds of the candidates who will respond to questions about these issues, but don't necessarily raise them themselves on the trail and sometimes appear uncomfortable to be talking about those issues and take pains to kind of take a compromise position, particularly on the issue of same-sex marriage, not as much, of course, on funding for Planned Parenthood. So, yes, it's not dominating the conversation, but there is a core of passionate voters, and the question is how much of an impact right. they'll wind up having.
Thank you, Nick, for your interesting call. Ivy in Evansville, hello.
Hi. In response to someone who brought up how Donald Trump doesn't have to take anybody's money, so he's not beholden, one who donates money, you would surmise, wants something for that, somebody who's very wealthy. He was on the donating end at one point, so he has been part of that game. He gave money to many politicians, so he says. So one has to assume that he wanted something from them. And so I just wanted to make that point that he's been part of the game. Thank you.
Thank you for the call, Ivy.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, the other thing to remember, of course, is that when you're someone, a businessman of his means, you can't escape being involved in the government one way or the other, sometimes in ways that wouldn't necessarily be as comfortable or people in his base wouldn't necessarily like to hear about. Of course, companies that he owns, he takes pains to say not himself personally, but companies that he owns have taken advantage of a bankruptcy reorganization. You know, he's worked with kind of public funding. His family, of course, his father made the family fortune working on affordable housing, government contracts. And so you can't necessarily escape this government funding. You can't necessarily say that he's not beholden to anyone or doesn't have any interest with the federal government. He's absolutely had interest with government. And he's explained his donations to Hillary Clinton and others by saying, I had to play the game. Mm-hmm. So in the past, he absolutely has played the game, as he now refers to it. And he's would like voters to accept the fact that he has kind of put a cap on that. And now he holds an entirely different position.
Mary in Pewaukee. Hi.
Hi. I think Kathleen touched base on it a bit with the reality TV comment. And to me, people that are, you know, the Republican candidates seem to be a dumbing down of America for those that support them with things like what two people had done to a Mexican street person,
yes,
you know, beating them up and then, you know, put it back on Trump with the candidate that is actually a surgeon, the Ben Carson, saying, you know, a drone to Arizona to get rid of the immigrants. Some of these things are just startling, and I can't believe that people are backing that kind of no empathy of situation. Whereas on the contrast, we have someone like Bernie Sanders, whose entire history of politics has been on the up and up and honesty and forthrightness, and he would, you know, he's detailing what he would do. So I just can't understand it. You know, to me, it's dumbing down.
Well, and it's also hardly appealing to the better angels of our nature, Rebecca.
Right, but that's not, you know, it's not necessarily his message. And there are voters out there who right now don't necessarily want their better angels appealed to. They would like people to hear their complaints. They would like people to feel their anger. And to some extent, Trump's a representation of that. There's other factors at work as well, obviously. But, you know, you don't necessarily win in politics by with a positive message. It is possible to win with a negative message, or at least to go very far, and to attract a very committed core of supporters.
Oh, yes. Well, thank you very much, Rebecca. It was quite a lively All Things Political, and I appreciate your thoughts and your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Rebecca Cinderbrand, she's political news editor for The Washington Post. Thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. We had many of them, and we'll continue our All Things Political conversations every Monday at 1 o'clock. It's always fun during an election year to hear what you're thinking, and if you change your minds as the time goes by. Thanks to Scotty Myers and KP Whaley for producing this hour. We have news coming up from National Public Radio. Those of you who have thought about the legacy of John Stewart, please share your thoughts, as will our guests coming up hour two of the program for this Monday.